this evening, and we're at a pace such that finds us up to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8 is a prophecy that deals with the rise of two different kingdoms and some events within one of those kingdoms. And a good part of it is fairly simple and straightforward. There's a short section in it that's pretty difficult and kind of tedious. Once you get there and understanding it, it's not a complicated explanation. It's just getting from point A to point B takes a little effort. Daniel chapter 8, the first two verses says, "The third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Uli." Now Daniel had gotten his vision in chapter 7, and he saw these four beasts, and they represented four kingdoms. And then on one of the beasts there's these horns, and those horns were kings within the kingdom. And it was all that detail that we studied the last time we studied the book of Daniel together. And this one follows that. And in making a point of that, there's an inference that there's a similarity between the previous chapter and this chapter. And there is a very obvious similarity. In both chapters, you have a certain number of beasts rising up, and those beasts each represent a kingdom. That's what you've got in Daniel chapter 7, and that's what you've got in Daniel chapter 8. And here he says he got this in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. And when you put the Babylonian captivity on a timeline like what we have it here, Nebuchadnezzar, their first primary king during their time of world dominance there in 562 was Nebuchadnezzar. That's when his reign ended. And the third year of the reign of Belshazzar in Daniel chapter 8 would have come in about 459 BC, as secular history reckons the successive reigns of the different Babylonian kings. That's tricky figuring that out because some of those kings had co-regents or guys that ruled along their side, and Belshazzar was one of them. But this gives you an idea that Daniel's prophecy is coming at a time that's not too far out from when the Medes and the Persians are going to overthrow Babylon and just conquer her and leave her helpless, at a time when the Babylonian Empire looked like nobody can whip this thing, because they had a capital city that was well defended by an unimaginably large and thick wall that fully encircled the city. And it just, if you looked at it as a military tactician in the 6th century BC and said, how are we going to conquer that thing? It's hopeless. It's hopeless. But yet Daniel is going to foretell that that's about to take place. Now in this vision, he has a vision of a ram. In Daniel chapter 8, verse 3 and 4. "I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great." Now observe that this ram pushes in all directions except the east, which sort of suggests he come from an easterly direction in comparison to the other empires that would be thought of in Daniel's day, which in this case, it's Babylon. The only other thing out there with any power at all was Egypt, and they were subjugated to Babylon. So this is something that seems like it's going to come from the east of Babylon, because it's going to push towards the west, and it's going to push towards the north and towards the south. This ram has two horns, and he makes an issue of the fact that one horn was higher than the other, just a little bit bigger. And he also says that the higher came up last. Well, now I said that this was a little before the Medo-Persian Empire came in and conquered Babylon. And let me just tell you about the Medo-Persian Empire. It was really the Persian Empire. But people that study the detail of history refer to it as the Medo-Persian Empire, because it was a coalition between the Persians and the Medes. Now, the Persians then was the greater part of that empire, the bigger horn. But the smaller part of that empire, the Medes, came up first. Historically, they rose to power before the Persians did, and they'd been there longer. The Persians, though they rose later, got bigger and became the dominant part of that coalition. And as you follow the history, you know, of their kings, it's a discussion of the Persian Empire, even though the Medes were a substantial part of it. The ram is depicted as pushing in all directions. No other beast was able to withstand. That the idea is that this nation that's coming is going to conquer in all directions and nobody can stop them. Until along comes this goat, verse 5. I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram, which had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran to him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him. But he cast him down to the ground and trampled him. And there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. So this goat comes along. He's just sailing above the ground. It's almost like he's flying. He's moving so quickly. And he's an unusual goat in that he's got one horn there between his eyes instead of two horns like a normal goat. And this goat comes at the ram from the westerly direction. His feet didn't touch the ground. He was moving so fast. And he had the one notable horn there on his head, and then he defeated the ram. And then it says, therefore the goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. So once the goat reached his zenith of power, and he destroyed the ram, that single horn was broken, and in its place came up four horns. That's the picture that he paints. Then on one of those horns, we read there was a little horn. Out of one of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down because of transgressions. An army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast the truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. It grew out of one of the four horns, that's this little horn. I'm pointing these things out to help us identify this little horn later in our study. He went towards the south, the east, and the pleasant land, as it's called in the King James. The New King James says glorious land. He caused the daily sacrifice to cease. That's important. And he's also depicted as doing things against the truth and against God and his people. So you get the idea that this little horn, whoever, whatever, wherever he, it is, it had to do with a power that would persecute God's people and end the daily sacrifice. Then there's a time period that's assigned to certain events within all these events. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said to that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now let's get this in context. He's been talking about an empire that would rise up from the east and conquer towards the west and conquer everybody. Then he talks about another empire that would rise up from the west and go towards the east and conquer everybody. And in that empire, there would be one notable king that when his time ended, there would be four come up in his place. And of those four, there would be one that would do all this persecuting, and he would cause the daily sacrifice to cease. That gets a Hebrew man's attention, because their religion revolved around the regularity of those sacrifices going on there at the temple. They That was very important under Moses' law. And so he says, how long is that going to be, this vision? Well, 2,300 days. Now, what he's asking about, did that have something to do with the end of time? Did it have something to do with the Battle of Armageddon, so-called at the end of time, or a so-called tribulation at the end of time, or the second coming of Christ? Is that what we have in this context? Does it have something to do with happening in 19th century America? I mean, when you look at the context, do you think we're reading a prophecy about 19th century America so far? Well, you might say, well, Dave, I don't know what we're reading about. Well, stay tuned. You will soon. But some of you already have an idea that, you know, whatever it's talking about, it's obviously talking about battles between empires back in Daniel's day. We can see that much already. And whatever this 2,300 day deal is, look, there's some people that take that and say, well, a day equals a year in prophecy, even though the Bible never says that. And so they start counting from, you know, 400 or 500 BC forward, 2,300 years, and get it up into modern times and say, I don't know why, he's foretelling something. I looked at a chart earlier today that somebody put up, and they had this happening during the so-called Great Tribulation that's supposed to happen just before the second coming of Christ, which the Bible doesn't teach. And I just want to ask us to notice that whatever all this stuff is about, you might look at it and feel like your wires are getting crossed, and that's okay. Just know this, it has something to do with the other stuff he's talking about there relating to that goat. And if we could ever figure out who the goat is and who that big horn is and then the four little horns are, then we're going to know that whatever this 2,300 days is, it's got something to do with that stuff. And we may never figure out the 2,300 days, but we can narrow it down to having something to do with those things. Okay, so let's see what we can do. He said this is going to last for 2,300 days. And what's going to happen at the end of the 2,300 days? He said the sanctuary will be cleansed. The word translated cleansed there can carry the idea of justification or vindication. It's about more than just cleaning something out of the temple that would have profaned it. Let's say, for example, if somebody took a pig, which under the law was an unclean animal, and they took that pig into the temple, well, they've already defiled it. And then they sacrifice that pig on the altar. Well, that's awful under the Moses law. And then they took broth from that pig and just poured it all over everything in there. That would be just about as vile a way to violate that thing as a Hebrew mind could imagine. Because all that in their mind, you know, when I say pig broth now, I'm thinking ham gravy. And I get excited, but they didn't get excited. They wrinkled their nose because in a ceremonial religious sense, that was vile and unclean. They weren't supposed to mess with that stuff. Okay? And so think of somebody doing something like that, and then somebody else coming in and getting the pig carcass out and cleaning all everything up and getting out all the things that defile it. You might say, well, that's a cleaning of the temple. That word that's translated cleanse there means more than that. Something's got to happen to vindicate or get revenge for whoever did that. That's what's captured in the meaning of the word that's translated cleanse there. And I'm telling you that for a reason. Daniel 8 verse 15. It came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning. Then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard the man's voice between the banks of Uli, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. And he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. For at the time appointed, the end shall be. He's not talking about the end of time. He's talking about the end of an indignation, something indignant that was done to God's people, and in particular, the sanctuary of the temple. So he's saying, I'm telling you about things that relate to events that unfold towards this temple really being desecrated. And that's big on Daniel's mind, because the Babylonians had done that to the temple until they finally destroyed it in his day. Daniel's grieving, wanted that hall to be rebuilt, which it eventually would be. And this is telling him about that temple having things that are indignant done to it. Okay, so this is all relevant to things that Daniel had on his mind about the shape of the temple there in Jerusalem, or the status, I should say, of that temple. All right, so the angel begins to explain. Verse 20. The ram which thou sawest having two horns, the kings of Media and Persia. There's no way to mess that up unless you just shut your eyes and say, no, it ain't. Remember what I said about the two horns? One was bigger than the other. That's Persia. But the smaller one came up first. That's the Medes. And that's easily verified in ancient history. All right, well, what about the goat? Well, the rough goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now, the Greek coalition of cities had had different rulers and kings throughout years, but they're the first king that was the king of Greece, that was the Greek empire that dominated the known world. That was Alexander the Great. And he conquered Persia so inexplicably fast. It was unreal. With a small band of soldiers that was much smaller than the Persian army. It'd be like South Korea rising up and sweeping through North Korea and China and just overthrowing all of them. I mean, if that happened, we'd just be, our jaws would be hanging open. How did that little old nation of South Korea, with their small army, go whip the multiple millions in the army of China? It just wouldn't make sense militarily. And that's what Alexander the Great did. And he didn't do it slow, grinding it out, barely getting it done. Took him decades to do it. He did it very quickly. Not in a modern age with, you know, fuel, motorized trucks and jet planes and fast cargo. He did it in an ancient day, where they're riding horses and hauling things on wagons, and it's all moving slow. And he swept across them like a hot knife through butter and wiped out the Persian Empire like a goat just sailing above the ground, just flying right through it. Went and hit that ram and just whipped him pitifully, and nobody could help. It was over before it barely got started. But you know what happened? Right at their zenith, right after conquering part of northern India, Alexander the Great died. That being broken, that's the big horn there. Whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. So Alexander the Great died, the first king of the Greek Empire. And when he died, his kingdom was divided over a period of time. This was all worked out between four generals, and you had four sections of the Greek Empire: Macedon, Thrace, Syria, and Egypt. There's your four little horns. And that's what it says. We don't have to wonder. Four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation. What nation? The nation he had just named, Greece. And by the way, Daniel's saying all this back when Greece wasn't even a blip on the radar. Greece was a group of primitive southern European cities is quarreling amongst themselves and couldn't even get along. To think that they would rise up and conquer somebody that was powerful enough to conquer the unconquerable Babylonians was just unthinkable. And Daniel's saying it, and he's naming them. I'm telling you, skeptics have a problem with the book of Daniel. They can't explain him naming these empires like that. So they just say, well, there was no Daniel, and this got all written after the fact, which can be easily disproved. And the reason they say that is because it's incredible that these prophecies were made in such precise detail, naming nations that didn't even exist as nations, as being the ones that would rise up and conquer and achieve these things. All right, now let's go back for just a second about this little horn. And about this 2,300 days. Let's stop and let's analyze this. I heard a guy say one time, well, that little horn, that was the Pope. Is there anything in this context that has anything to do with the papacy or the Roman Catholic Church? Well, but the Pope did this, 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 and that. Doesn't matter. Let's look at the context. You can find a number of figures throughout history that make it fit pieces of the description here. But whatever we do with all this, we've got to fit it to the context. And the context is this has something to do with the Greek Empire after Alexander the Great died and that thing split in four kingdoms. Somewhere out of that's going to come this little horn that's going to desecrate the temple, and then that's going to be vindicated or avenged. And there's something to do with 2300 days related to all that. And there's no way to stretch from this context to something towards the end of time or some battle of Armageddon or the Roman Catholic Church or any of those other crazy theories you'll find out there. They just won't fit the context. Now, if you skip the context and just start reading about the little horn, you can draw all kinds of conclusions, but that's not how we study the Bible. We study the Bible in context, and we look for the things in their setting to see what answers that we can find, and that helps us come to a better conclusion. So let's read about the little horn. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And his power shall be mighty, not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. Okay, so whoever this little horn is, it's somebody that's a he who comes to power. It sounds like a king, doesn't it? It's something that happens kind of towards the end of this four-way division of the Greek Empire. It's somebody who's pretty clever. They can understand difficult things. It's somebody that can wield great power. It's somebody that would fight against the Lord, the Prince of Princes, and his holy people. Sounds like somebody that would go in and defile the sanctuary, which is what was foretold about him earlier in the chapter. Now notice he said he would be broken without hand. That means he's going to die, but it's not going to be dying in battle like you would think a warrior king would do. So it sounds like that this guy, whoever he is, that's fighting against God's people, it turns out that he had a tiger by the tail and he bit off more than he could chew is what it sounds like. And when the Lord got good and ready, the Lord broke him without hand. Well, when you look within the four-way division of the Greek Empire, you can find all kinds of fantastic kings that did a lot of crazy things. But you'll only find one that fits everything that's described about him here. You find one that came along in the latter time of the Grecian Empire, 175 BC. It wasn't long after that that the Romans were getting the better toehold. In fact, the Romans gained the upper hand over the Greeks during this guy's reign. That's when they begin to gain the upper hand. This guy was extremely clever, more so than many of his contemporaries. He attacked towards the south, Egypt, the east, Parthians, and the pleasant land, that's Palestine or Israel. He persecuted the Jews and brought down various rulers. He caused the daily sacrifice in the Jewish temple to cease, like we talked about a moment ago. They went in there and offered a pig on the altar. They poured pig broth all over the place and defiled it. He achieved great power that by trickery more than by force. He practiced trickery and deceit to a science. He was very notorious for this method of operation. He resisted the Lord, restricting worship of God, and he set himself up as a god. And his demise came not at the hands of someone else, such as in battle. Instead, he died of a loathsome disease. The figure that I'm talking to you about is a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus the Fourth. He was the fourth in that Antiochian dynasty. So he called Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes. The Jews called him Antiochus Epimenes, as a play on words, and that word Epimenes to them meant a madman, because that's how they thought of him. The guy's just insane. And he was very treacherous in the things that he did against God's people in the temple and the persecutions that he wrought. He was a horrible, horrible man. And when it come down to it, he caught a disease. And it was a disease in his digestive tract where he had basically parasites living inside of him, devouring him from the inside out. And when you read the historical accounts of his final days, it's bone chilling. Because he got to a point that he was so vile and foul smelling and foul tempered that none of his most loyal servants would even come near him and have anything to do with him. All he could do was just waller on the ground and scream in pain for days on end until he died. Just lay there in a foul stench of his own dying until he was done. Mess with God's people. Some people choose to do that. And occasionally you get someone like this springs up that the Lord uses as an example to show everybody what happens when you cross the Lord. That's what happened with Antiochus Epiphanes. He's the little horn. He come up out of one of those divisions, the Greek Empire, the Seleucid or the Syrian division. And he fits all the description that's given there in the text. And so we've got this thing sort of sprawled out on a map now. You've got the Persians coming to power in 536. You've got Alexander the Great conquering the Persians. Then you've got his kingdom divided when he died in 323. Into the four horns, and then you've got this little 2300 day period. The Medo-Persian Empire, Alexander the Great, the Greek Empire divided four ways, and then this 2300 day period down here towards the end. Now I've got that put on the chart, but I hadn't explained it yet. So let's go explain it. What about this time period, the 2300 days? What about that? Well, let's go back and look at our analysis from the context. Whatever it is, we're not going to arbitrarily say a day equals a year and start counting forward and wind up somewhere in the 20th century America. We're not going to just ignore the context and say it's the end of time. We're going to say that whatever it is, it's got to have something to do with this little horn, Antiochus Epiphanes, defiling the temple and that action being avenged. And all that happening within the Greek Empire and all that stuff. We're looking for something from the context because the 2300 days is placed as a part of that context. We're looking at something from the context that will fit all that. Verse 26 speaks of it as the vision of the evening and the morning, which was told as true. So he said, shut up the vision, so it'll be for many days. And this would have been 300-400 years after the time that Daniel was writing. When all this happened. And when you look that far into the future, it shall be for many days, and you land during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, you find that when he came to power, one of his early actions was he stole the temple treasure there, and that's recorded in history. I've got one of the references up there on the screen. There are multiple references to that. The reason he did it was because he needed to finance his war with the Ptolemies down in Egypt. He was spending a lot of money sending his armies all over the place trying to get more territory. Well, that's not cheap now, and it wasn't cheap then, and he needed more money, and there set the temple treasury up there in Jerusalem. Well, I'll go up there and bully them and take all that treasure, and that's just what he did. And that happened in 169 B.C. And that began a rapid-fire series of events that included him persecuting the Jews, and in particular him acting against the temple, prohibiting the worship of God, setting himself up as a god, and all kinds of terrible things that he did against the Jews. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse until the Jews pulled themselves together and formed sort of a guerrilla militia, and they started making raids against the armies of Antiochus Epiphanes and gaining power and making raids until they finally defeated them and chased them out, and then Antiochus got sick and died. And when he died, his actions against the temple were avenged. Does that sound anything like the temple being cleansed?
So you take from 169 to 163, and the times of the year when that happened, that's a little over 6 years. Now, if you take 2,300 days and stretch it out on a Jewish calendar, you've got a little over 6 years. Okay, so we found something. We found something that fits the context, that's specific to the language of this man's actions against the sanctuary, against the Jewish temple. From the first time he went in and robbed it until the time that he died a miserable death as an act of God's revenge against him for all those things. And when we looked at the beginning event and the end event and counted the days, we come landing in on a period close to 2,300 days. That was enough for me because it fits the context, it fits the dates in history. If somebody wants to take that forward and stretch it into 20th century America or try to make it the Pope or something else, I don't know how you can do that. I don't claim to have all a perfect understanding of all these things, but it certainly looks to me like we're in the ballpark of something that's reasonable and consistent with other things that are said in the context. Now let's lay this alongside everything else we've studied from the book of Daniel. In Daniel chapter 2, we studied about an image that had four sections representing Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. When we got to Daniel chapters 4 and 5, we read about events within the Babylonian Empire and King Nebuchadnezzar there being put out to pasture. We read about the handwriting on the wall, which marked the end of the Babylonian Empire and the commencement of the Persian Empire. In Daniel 4, we had four beasts, a winged lion that represented Babylon, a bear that was eating ribs that represented Medo-Persia, a four-headed leopard with four wings that we found out represented Greece, and then a terrible beast with a bunch of horns on his head that represented Rome. Now we're in Daniel chapter 8, and we got the idea of coming right out of the gate. It's kind of like the previous chapter, and sure enough it is. Only now it's not a bear, it's a ram with two horns. And it's not a leopard, it's a goat with one horn. And then later that goat's got four horns for reasons to describe what happened within the empire. And then there's this 2,300-day prophecy that had to do with things that one of those kings did against God's people, and in particular against the temple. And all of that we've talked about here fits neat and clean right in with all the other prophecies of Daniel. Lines up perfectly. Next time we study, Lord willing, we'll talk about the 77s of Daniel chapter 9. We'll show how it fits within the same framework. Then we'll talk about Daniel chapter 11, prophecies of the Persian kings, of Alexander the Great, of this four-way division of the Greek Empire, and specific details of events within that empire. Then we'll look at something from Daniel chapter 12 that's a prophecy of 1,290 days and 1,335 days. I look forward to being able to get to that point with you. Well, there's all kinds of things that we can gather from this, but I hope you're gathering the validity of God's word with such precise prophecies naming these nations and specifying what would happen. And I hope you're gathering God's righteous wrath against sin. He put up with a lot, but he reaches his breaking point where he's done. So we can see God's patience, love, and forbearance, but we can also see his righteous wrath against sin. And when we think about how that relates to us, I hope it's obvious what it says. He's been patient with us. He'll be patient with us. But he does have wrath against sin. We need to be mindful of that and make sure we've taken appropriate measures to avert that wrath. And of course, we do so through his son, Jesus. If you've not done that yet in your life, you need to. You need to be a Christian. We'd love to help you with that. Or if as a Christian you need the church to pray for you, we'd be glad to assist you with that. If we can help you in either way, please come. Have a seat on the front pew while we stand and while we sing.